The BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the program and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words, and those taking part are Anne Scott James, Dillis Powell, Frank Muir, and Dennis Norden. Here's round one to try and test their vocabulary. 2 marks if they can get the meaning of these words right. Beginning with Anne Scott James. Anne, the meaning of the word recrudescent. R-E-C-R-U-D-E-S-C-E-N-T. Recrudescent.
It means busting out all over, really.
Yes.
Or re-busting out all over.
That's it. And applied normally to what?
Well, I should think if you sort of cut a tree off in half and it started putting out new leaves, you'd say, my plane tree is recrudescent, wouldn't you?
That's right. Yes, that's good. 2 marks it is. Breaking out again, it can refer to a disease or a sore or an epidemic. Or it can refer to conflict or discontent in the figurative sense. Well done, 2 marks. Thank you. The meaning of the word androgynous, A-N-D-R-O-G-Y-N-O-U-S, androgynous.
Yes, it means a morbid fear of buttercups.
It might, among
it
other
does.
Things.
Well, it's been whispered in my... I scarcely can bring myself to say it. Can I bring somebody else? It's, Dillis seems to think it's...
I may be
both
wrong.
Men and women.
Yes, it is.
Married couple.
No, it has to be one. It's something...
Hermaphroditic.
That's it. Something unites the characters of both sexes, hermaphrodite. And in order to save your blushes, Frank, it's mostly used botanically. It means plants which have got pistil and stamen in the same flower or plant.
Oh, plants are filthy. Some of those diagrams.
All right, you get 2 marks. Dillis Powell, the meaning of the word eclectic.
Choosing. Choosy.
Yes, that's a bit of it. It isn't quite enough, I think, Dillis.
It's not enough.
Mm-hmm.
Well, picking out, it means some...
The eclectic philosophers?
Well, they picked out from the possibilities of philosophy.
Mm-hmm. The things that...
Which appeal to.
Yes. That's it. Yes, I get you, 2 marks. This is often misused as a word.
Not by us.
Well, very nearly. Originally, it was an ancient philosopher who selected the doctrines which appealed to him in every school of philosophy, and there was a school called the Eclectic Philosophers. Nowadays, it means somebody who is not exclusive or dogmatic in his opinion or his tastes, but who borrows freely from various opinions and various sources. And this is often, as I say, slightly misused. 2 marks. Dennis Norden, what is a frit fly? F-R-I-T hyphen F-L-Y. Frit fly.
F-R-I-T.
Yep.
Well, it looks like a non-you fruit fly. A frit is what they call chips in France, actually. So if you had some chips on your lap in France and they soaked through the paper, when you got up, you'd have a frit fly.
It's a beautiful picture, but it won't do.
I'm no good on bugs.
Perhaps
it's a blue bottle, or perhaps it isn't a blue bottle.
It's a small fly which is destructive to wheat and, I think, oats. Tiny, shiny, and black. And it lays eggs in the plant, and they hatch maggots, and they feed on the shoots and on the growing ears, and you don't get any oats or any porridge or any wheat or any bread. No marks at all. Well, before we begin round two, I give each team a quotation for them to write down, and I want the 2 women members of our teams to study them, and at the end of the program, I shall ask them where those quotations come from. So, beginning with Anne Scott James and Dennis Norden, here's your quotation. United we stand, divided, we fall. And Dillis Powell and Frank Muir, yours is, a rose is a rose is a rose is a rose. And then at the end of the program, I shall ask Dennis and Frank to give me their ideas of how these words came to be said or written. Round two is a quickie round. I want to know, for 2 marks, who wrote the following works. Anne Scott James, Morning Becomes Electra.
Eugene O'Neill.
Yes, 2 marks. Frank Muir, the Threepenny Opera.
Oh, this was a rewrite of an English musical show called Half a Sixpence. Or the Beggar's Opera.
The Beggar's Opera, yes.
It was written by Bertolt Brecht and Kurt Weill.
That's right. Absolutely right, and I'm glad you said those names with sufficient reverence. Dennis Power, Tamburlaine.
Marlowe.
Christian name?
Christopher.
I didn't mean Tamburlaine's Christian name, sorry. 2 marks
it is.
And Dennis Norden, 6 characters in search of an author.
Pirandello.
Well done. 2 marks it is. Absolutely full score. Well, the next round's all about verse and poetry, and I give each member of each team a quotation and ask them to complete it by the next line or two. 2 marks if they can complete the quotation, and 2 more for correctly naming its source. Beginning with Anne Scott James. Good name in man and women, dear my lord, is the immediate jewel of their souls.
Well, I would say Shakespeare at a venture.
Yes.
Yeah, it's... Isn't it he who steals my purse
yes.
steals trash?
Quite
right. Who? Who was it? Iago.
Yes.
Oh, you are clever. Mm.
In?
Othello. Even I can do
all right.
that.
That'll do. Yes, you get your 4 marks. Good name in man and woman, dear my lord, is the immediate jewel of their souls. Who steals my purse steals trash. Tis something, nothing. Twas mine, tis his, and has been slave to thousands. But he that filches from me my good name robs me of that which not enriches him and makes me poor indeed. 4 marks. Frank Muir. At me you smiled, but unbeguiled, I saw the snare and I retired. And some leagues further on come the lines, kind hearts are more than coronets.
Ah. Lady Clara, Vere de Vere.
Yes, come on.
By Alfred Lord, Croquet, Tennyson.
Good.
And the poem?
Lady Clara Vere de Vere.
Yes. At me you smiled, but unbeguiled, I saw the snare and I retired. The daughter of 100 earls, you are not one to be desired. Tennyson's Lady Clara Vere de Vere. Now, Dillis Powell, the ice was here, the ice was there, the ice was all around.
It cracked and growled.
Yes.
And roared and howled like noises in a swound.
Yes.
Ancient Mariner.
Absolutely right. 4 marks you get. The ice was here, the ice was there, the ice was all around. It cracked and growled and roared and howled like noises in a swound. Coleridge's Ancient Mariner. Dennis Norden. The sons of the prophet are brave men and bold and quite unaccustomed to fear.
What's that song?
Yeah.
And the brave is by far the shark was Abdul the Bulbul.
Yes.
I don't know. It was sung by a man called Frank Crummett.
That's good.
It was, yeah.
And written by?
I don't know.
Yeah, well, quite right. Nobody does.
Wasn't right. that bright of me not to know?
All right, 4 marks. The sons of the prophet are brave men and bold and quite unaccustomed to fear, but the bravest by far in the ranks of the Shah was Abdul the Bulbul Amir. All right, on to the next round. I want to know in which Shakespeare plays the following female characters play leading parts. Beginning with Anne Scott James, Rosalind, or if you prefer it, Rosaline.
As you like it.
Yep, 2 marks. Frank Muir, Beatrice.
Well, it's not as you like it, because you wouldn't have two at once. Beatrice, oh, yeah. It's one of the pastorale ones, isn't
All's
it?
Well,
All's well.
No.
Measure for measure.
Much ado about nothing.
Yes,
too much. Pure guess.
Much ado about nothing. Dearest Power, Cordelia.
King Lear.
2 marks. Dennis Norton, Miranda.
Tempest.
Yes. Also Belloc.
Somebody in the audience is doing the Tempest.
All right. Correct all the way through. Well, the next round's about foreign language expressions which have come to be used in English, mainly expressing a certain state or condition or opinion. 2 marks if you tell me what the following mean. Beginning with M. Scott James, O tempora, O mores.
Oh, it's a generally gloomy expression, O times, O customs, mm-hmm. which means how everything's going to the dogs.
Since?
Latin.
Since?
Oh, since the better times past.
Yes. Do you
tempora
remember
acti.
Do you remember who it came from?
Laudato tempora acti, would say it, if I might show a
bit. Yes, that's it. Do you remember the author? It doesn't matter. I'll mark you without that.
I should think Virgil.
No.
Horace.
Yes, Horace.
Roy. Yes, Horace.
Well done. 2 marks you get. It means, oh, the times and manners, they've all gone to pot. As compared to the days when I was a young man. And it comes from the Latin poet Horace. Frank Muir, verbum sat sapienti, or verb sap for short.
Well, I knew the short, I didn't know the long. Verb sap. It means nuff said.
Yes.
Well, does it or doesn't it?
It gets there more or less in the end. I'd like a slightly more accurate translation.
Yes, a word to the wise is sufficient.
Yes,
a nod is as good as a wink to a blind drunk, you know.
That's all right. 2 marks it is. A word to the wise is enough, otherwise a wise man can take a hint. Dearest Powell, cordon bleu.
Well, it means a blue ribbon in cooking.
But why?
Because good cooks were given blue ribbons.
Very rarely in my experience.
They went to a school which was called the Cordon Bleu. Mm. Did they?
But it comes from?
It's a kind of order.
Yes, I know you're getting there.
It's an order.
Mm. Do you remember which it was?
The bath.
No, the bath.
The garter.
Yes.
The garter.
The garter in this country. It's anything first class of the highest distinction, and nowadays it's most frequently applied to cooking and sometimes to the cooks themselves. But it was originally the blue ribbon worn by the Knight's Grand Cross of the Order of the Holy Ghost, which was the highest order of chivalry under the Bourbon monarchy, rather equivalent to our garter. Dennis Norden, a posteriori.
Oh, Lord. And be careful.
Yes. It's terribly difficult to explain. It means from behind.
Yes.
Now, wait a minute. If you present an a posteriori case, you are taking a set of facts and drawing from them a general conclusion.
Yes.
As against if you're arguing a priori,
yes,
when you take a particular circumstance and say what generally happens in this case is so and so, therefore we presume it's going to happen here as well.
Absolutely right. Yes. Well done. 2 marks it is. It means in Latin from what comes after. It means arguing from effect to cause. That is by induction. This is all Sherlock Holmes stuff. That's that kind of reasoning. Exactly the opposite of a priori, which reasons from cause to effect by deduction. So, a posteriori works backwards from the result to the cause, while a priori works forward from the original cause to the eventual effect. Well, now we come to the last round and go back to those quotations I gave the two teams earlier on in the program. 2 marks, please. Anne Scott James, can you give me the origin of your quotation, which was, united we stand, divided we fall?
I think it's a fable.
Yes?
Which presumably means it's Aesop.
Yes, it is. I think that's good enough. Do you remember what the characters were?
Well, I was trying to work it out. There were a lot of animals in it.
Yes. Always are, yeah.
Lambs and a lion.
A lion. I'll give you your marks for getting one of the characters right. Two marks it is. It's the lion and the four oxen. As long as they stuck around together, the lion couldn't get at. And then he began telling one oxen dirty stories about the other one, and one ox, rather. And so they began separating in gloomy in corners by themselves, and the lion ate them up one after the other. Two marks. Now, Didis Powell, the origin of your quotation, which is simple in its makeup, a rose is a rose is a rose is a rose.
Gertrude Stein.
Gertrude Stein. You don't remember what the book was. It isn't essential.
No, I wouldn't.
All right. Gertrude Stein.
Topless cookbook.
Gertrude Stein, a very controversial American author who lived in Paris most of her life. And this is a book called Sacred Emily. Two marks. Well, now I shall ask Frank and Dennis to give me their explanation of how these quotations came into being. And on this occasion, the marks will go to whichever incredible explanation receives the longer amount of applause from the audience here in the theatre. So back to Dennis Norton with his line, "United we stand, divided we fall."
Well, in this country, we celebrate the anniversary of the Magna Carta. But one right which the Magna Carta did bequeath us was the right to appeal to the sovereign in any case where the individual felt himself in dire distress. And that appeal I'm going to make now through the magic of radio. Your Majesty, I would like to humbly draw your attention to a radio program called My Word, which for many years has furnished the necessities of life for four of your loyal subjects and one loyal object. This program was devised and is compiled every week by another subject of yours, slightly fatter than any of the others, called Edward J. Mason, who is known as Ted by those of us who love him as much as he does. Now, Ted, for many of these long years, has toiled through the dictionaries and the books of quotations in order to make this program, which is now heard in every English-speaking country in the world, and one of the very few BBC programs which is broadcast in the Soviet Union. When the news came about this, Ted came flying in very excited, and he said, "This should do it. We're earning rubles for the old country." He said, "We are exporting words. This should do it." So I said, "Do what?" He said, "Get me my knighthood." He said, "It's what I've worked for all my life, Sir Edward Mason." So his anxiety was understandable when the last honours list was published. And he came flying in to me with his beard waving like a ferret's hip in a high wind. And he said, "Will you look at this?" And he thrust this paper in front of me. He said, "Look what they've done. Nothing." He said, "Very well, I give the nation fair warning. Unless I get a knighthood in the next honours list, then I'm withdrawing the programme." So now we come to what they refer to in the potato crisp commercials as the crunch. Unless Ted feels that sword on his shoulder, then for four of your loyal subjects, there is only the prospect of penury and possibly having to go to work. Comes at a time of dire financial difficulty for all of us. Dillis Powell is just about to pay the last payment on her new motorbike. So, Your Majesty, if you could somehow bring yourself to allow him this honour, I don't think it could be better put than it was put those many years ago by that grand old Greek Aesop, leader of that swinging group, the Fables, when he said, "Your Majesty, you knight, Ted, we stand. Defy, Ted, We four.
I've just seen Ted leaving control room to get his frock coat cleaned. Well, now we go on to the other line, which is Frank Muir's. And if you remember, that was, a rose is a rose is a rose is a rose.
I don't know if you're interested in literary mysteries, but that line, a rose is a rose is a rose is a rose, written by Gertrude Stein. When you consider a rubbishy line like that, apparently means nothing, written by Gertrude Stein, when you think of the Stein family, when you think of her brothers, Epp, the sculptor, Ein, the mathematician, Hammer, who wrote the musical compass, the world is full of the Stein family, and there's all these brilliant men, and there's their sister, Gertrude. Then I thought, you know, suppose it's a very important line, which has only been spoken, perhaps centuries ago, and handed down from foot to mouth throughout the generation. And she had been the first one to write it down. Had she, in fact, written something down which is phonetically the same as a rose, is a rose, is a rose, is a rose, but was actually not said quite like that. I brooded over this. Next few years, I studied up the subject. I read all about ancient Rome. I suddenly found a clue. And it appeared that when Nero retired, he retired to a villa outside Rome. And this set me thinking, if Nero retired to a villa, what does an old retired civil servant do with his time? He grows roses. And this suddenly connected up with this. Was there a clue here, I thought. And I learnt the truth. And it's really rather interesting. She had corrupted that line, you know. See, what happened was this. Nero retired from the job. Rome was in ashes. And he retired to his villa. It was his ambition, before he died, to grow 2 rows of roses. But, of course, he was on the sunny side of the hill. And nothing would grow under the hot Italian sky. Now, he had a slave, an angle. They all did, you see. You've got all sorts of angles, depending which part of England they came from. If they came from near London or Brum, they were acute angles. But if they came from the country, they were obtuse angles. And some of them weren't actually captured, but they were sort of washed ashore from boats in the rough sea off the south of Italy. They were wrecked angles, but they weren't... there's no good talking to them because they're very square. No, the Nero's slave, his name was Isosceles, was from the country, and he was an obtuse angle. And Nero said to him, if you can help me grow these roses, so they, instead of just dying, they actually rise out of the ground. I will give you your freedom. So the old obtuse angle, old Isosceles thought about it. He tried everything. He tried putting manure on them. Then he realized that the sun was the problem. He said, well, we in England, we mulch them, you see. So he went around and got hay. And he very carefully mulched the first row of these would-be glorious red roses. But being of a obtuse angle, while he was mulching the first row, he was treading on the second row, and he killed them off. But rather than confess his fault to Nero and be decapitated, he sneaked out that night to a man called Cicero. It wasn't the Cicero, it was Fred Cicero. He was a retired orator on the shady side of the hill. And Cicero grew the only yellow roses in Rome. And our old Isosceles, he dug up in the middle of the night a complete row of Cicero's roses and planted them in Nero's garden and mulched them with straw. Now, the following day, Isosceles went on his fortnight's holiday to Pisa. He always went to Pisa because he had a leaning to architecture. Now, when he came back, he was all agog to see how his roses had done. And it was night time, and old Nero had retired to bed. But there was a tablet with an inscription on it. And the slave realized that the roses had come up, but Nero had suspected that there'd been a fiddle. And then the slave realized that he put yellow roses in among Nero's red. And what Nero had written on the tablet was simply, a rose is a rose is a rose is a rose. You see, if you say it quickly. What he actually said was, our roses have come up. But isn't one of the lines of them roses belonging to our neighbour, Cicero? You see, what he said, if you say it slowly, was, our roses a rose is a rose, Cicero.
By your vote, Frank Muir just wins the contest of the stories with Dennis Norden, and that brings us to a final score in which, nevertheless, Anne Scott James and Dennis Norden win by one half of a mark from Dennis Bowell and Frank Muir, and this also brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dillis Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland. The programme was devised by Tony Shryan and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC. ¶¶